The Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas, performed by Patrick Horgan. Part 1, Chapter 1, The Three Gifts of Monsieur d'Artagnan the Elder. On the first Monday of April, 1625, the market town of Meaux, the birthplace of the author of the Roman de la Rose, was in a wild state of excitement. The commotion could not have been greater if the Huguenots had arrived to make a second La Rochelle of it. Many of the wealthier citizens, seeing the women running towards the high street and hearing the children screaming on the doorsteps of their houses, hastily buckled on their cuirasses, and to give themselves an air of greater assurance than they really possessed, seized muskets or halberds. Thus armed, they made for the Jolly Miller Inn, where they found a dense and excited throng of people swarming in from all directions. At that time, panics were frequent, and few days passed without one town or another recording in its archives some event of this kind. Noblemen were at war with one another. The king was at war with the cardinal, Spain was at war with the king, and besides these public and private wars, there were other elements which kept the French countryside in a state of almost perpetual unrest. Notably, thieves, beggars, Huguenots, and rabble of all sorts. The citizens always took up arms against this rabble. They often fought the noblemen and the Huguenots, sometimes even the king, though never Spain or the cardinal. So, from sheer force of habit, on this bright April morning, hearing an uproar and seeing neither the red and yellow standard of Spain nor the Duc de Richelieu's livery, the citizens rushed in a body to the Jolly Miller Inn, prepared for battle. The moment they reached the inn, the cause of the uproar was discovered. A young man was standing at the main gate, a young man of striking appearance. He was 18 years of age, tall and lanky, dressed in a blue woolen doublet, faded and threadbare, brown breeches and brown top boots. He had a long, tanned face, high cheekbones, a mark of shrewdness, frank, intelligent eyes, a hooked but well-cut nose, and an enormously protruding, typically Gascon jaw. He wore the Gascon beret, decorated with a jaunty feather, though even without it there would have been no mistaking his origin. His bearing was haughty, and his attitude challenging. There was an "I'm as good as you are, and tell me I'm not" look about him. An untrained eye might have taken him to be a farmer's son on a journey, but for the long sword which he wore hung from a shoulder strap, and which dangled against his calves when he walked, and when he was astride, against his horse's rough coat. Standing in front of the inn in full view of the crowd, one hand on his hip and the other holding his horse's bridle, his head erect, his legs apart, back to the wall against the world, he reminded one at once of Don Quixote, the Spanish hero of romance, the tilter at windmills. Don Quixote without his medieval accoutrements, and his horse was quite ridiculous enough to fill the part of Rosinante. It was this horse, indeed, which had first attracted the attention of the crowd. It was a Bernese cob, 12 to 14 years old, with a rat tail and ulcers on its feet, which jogged along mournfully from sunrise till sunset at a steady speed of 4 miles an hour, drooping its head so low between its knees that it needed no curb or martingale. Unfortunately, this animal's good qualities were not appreciated, so strange was its coat and so awkward its stride. At that time, all men were connoisseurs in horseflesh, and the sight of this cob, which had entered Meaux by the Beaugency gate some 15 minutes earlier, caused a sensation which reflected badly on its rider. And this sensation was very painful to our young Don Quixote. D'Artagnan was his name, because he was a good horseman, and realized that he cut a poor figure on his Rosinante. And when Monsieur d'Artagnan the Elder had presented it to his son as a parting gift, our hero had groaned inwardly, although he knew that the animal was worth at least 7 crowns, and that the words of wisdom which went with the gift were beyond price. "My son," the old squire had said, in that thick brogue which is the lifelong distinctive mark of all true Gascons, "this horse was born in your father's stables nearly 13 years ago, and has lived here ever since. Treasure it for that reason. Don't think of selling it. Let it live its normal span and die happy and respected. If you go campaigning with it, treat it with kindness you would show an old servant. At court, if you ever go to court, which of course you're quite entitled to do, seeing who you are. Be honest and above board with everyone. Always remember your rank, and carry on the tradition of good behaviour which your family has been true to for the past 500 years. This you owe to yourself, and to your nearest and dearest. Stand no nonsense from anyone but the King and the Cardinal. Remember, nowadays, it's only by personal courage that a man can get on in the world. If you see an opportunity, don't stop to think, but seize it, or you may lose it forever. If that fails, try something else. You've got 2 good reasons for being brave. First, that you're a Gascon, and secondly, that you're my son. Don't fight shy of adventures. I'd sooner you live dangerously. I've taught you to handle a sword. You've got good strong legs and a wrist of steel. Fight at the least provocation, in season and out, because now that duelling's illegal, the man who fights shows himself to be doubly brave. I wish I had more to give you, my dear boy, but here's all I have. 15 crowns, my horse, and these few words of advice. Your mother will give you the prescription for a special ointment which she got from an old gypsy woman, and which has the miraculous property of healing all wounds except heart wounds. Make the most of these gifts, and may your life be long and happy. There's just one thing I might add, by the way. I'd like to give you an example to model your life on. Not myself, for I've never been to court and only served as a volunteer in the religious wars. Not myself, I say, but Monsieur de Treville, who was at one time my neighbour, a Gascon, like myself, and who, as a child, was the honoured playmate of our good King Louis XIII, whom God preserve. Sometimes their childish games became regular tussles, and sometimes the King got the worst of it. His Majesty remembers to this day how Monsieur de Treville used to set about him, and has as much respect for him now as he had then. Since then, Monsieur de Treville has had many another tussle, 5 on his first journey to Paris alone, and between the death of the late king and the coming of age of this one, 7 more, all serious duels, not counting the various campaigns he fought in. Between this king's accession to power and the present day, he's fought at least 100 other duels, perhaps more. He's defied edicts, ordinances and decrees, and see where he's got to. He's captain of the musketeers. In other words, head of a band of daredevil heroes who are high in the king's favour and who terrify the cardinal. The great cardinal. And it takes a good deal to frighten him, as we all know. Added to which, Monsieur de Treville has an income of 10,000 crowns and is therefore a very big man. He started life as you did. Go to him with this letter. Do as he tells you. And perhaps one day you'll get where he is. With these words, Monsieur d'Artagnan the elder buckled his own sword round his son's waist, kissed him affectionately on both cheeks, and gave him his blessing. The young man left his father's room and went to say goodbye to his mother, who was waiting for him with the precious prescription, which he was bound to need if he followed the advice of his father. The farewell scene between him and his mother was longer, and more affectionate, than that between him and his father. Not that Monsieur d'Artagnan did not love his son, his only son, but he was a man, and therefore thought it wrong to give way to his feelings. Madame d'Artagnan, being a woman and also a mother, collapsed in her son's arms and sobbed aloud. Her son tried hard to keep calm, as became a future musketeer, but his warmer feelings prevailed, and he too shed bitter tears, although he turned his head away as he did so. That very day the young man set forth, armed with his father's 3 gifts, the 15 crowns, the horse, and the letter for Monsieur de Treville. The good advice had been given as an afterthought. Thus equipped, and with his father's words imprinted on his mind, D'Artagnan was, both morally and physically, an exact copy of Cervantes' hero, with whom we at first compared him. Don Quixote mistook windmills for giants and sheep for armies, whilst our young Gascon took every smile for a sneer and every stare for a challenge. The result was that in the stretch of road between Tarbes and Mans, he held his fist permanently clenched and clutched at his sword hilt roughly 10 times a day. No jaw, however, collided with his fist, and his sword never left its scabbard. It was only natural that the passers-by should break into broad grins when they caught sight of the yellow nag, but they prudently stifled their mirth, or at least tried to laugh out of the corners of their mouths, like ancient masks, when they saw the good long sword, which clanked above the yellow nag, and then again the proud, not to say fierce, eye, which flashed above the sword. D'Artagnan had, in fact, suffered no loss of dignity until he reached that wretched town of Meaux. Here, as he was dismounting at the door of the Jolly Miller, without anyone, host, ostler, or stable-boy, coming to hold his stirrup at the block, D'Artagnan noticed a gentleman standing at a half-open window on the ground floor of the inn. A tall, distinguished-looking man, with a rather scowling expression. He was talking to two other men, who appeared to be listening to his words with deference. As usual, D'Artagnan presumed that he was the object of the conversation and stood listening. This time, he was only half mistaken, though it was not he but his horse which had engaged the gentleman's attention. The stranger was explaining to his listeners the animal's points one by one, and his audience appeared to agree with him, and whenever the gentleman spoke, his listeners shouted with laughter. Now, we know that the mere suspicion of a smile was enough to anger our young friend, so we can imagine how he reacted to these offensive explosions of mirth. But D'Artagnan decided first to take stock of this insolent stranger's appearance. He looked at him haughtily, and observed that he was a man of 40 to 45, with shrewd dark eyes, a pale skin, a pronounced nose, and a well-trimmed black moustache, and that he wore a violet doublet and hose with aiguillettes of the same colour, with no trimmings except the usual slashes through which his shirt appeared. The doublet and hose, though new, appeared creased, like travelling clothes which had long been carried about in a valise. D'Artagnan took in all these details with the speed of an acute observer, and his instincts told him that the stranger was destined to play a big part in his life. The gentleman chose the very moment at which D'Artagnan was taking stock of him and his violet doublet to make one of his most scholarly and profound observations about the Bernese cob. His two listeners roared with laughter, and even he allowed the faintest flicker of a smile to pass across his face. This time there was no doubt of it. D'Artagnan had been actually insulted. Convinced of this, he pulled his beret down over his eyes, and aping some of the airs and graces of a courtier, which he had learnt from noblemen travelling through Gascony, stepped forward with one hand on his sword hilt and the other on his hip. Unfortunately, as he approached his enemy, his anger increased. He completely lost his head, and instead of protesting like an insulted gentleman, shook his fist and became vulgarly abusive. "Hi there!" he cried. "Yes, you, sir. Skulking behind that shutter, what are you laughing at? When I see a man laughing, I always like to be told the joke so that I can laugh too." The gentleman slowly lifted his eyes from the horse to its rider, as though it took him quite a while to realise that he was the object of this rather strange attack. Then, as there seemed to be no doubt of it, he frowned slightly, and after a longish pause answered D'Artagnan in a tone of amused contempt.
"I was not talking to you, sir."
"No, but I was talking to you, sir," cried the young man, stung by the stranger's manner, at once easy and supercilious. The stranger looked again at D'Artagnan with a faint smile, and leaving the window came slowly out of the inn and took his stand a few steps away from him, facing the horse. His composed look and the sardonic expression in his eyes increased the enjoyment of his companions, who were still standing at the window. D'Artagnan, seeing him approach, drew his sword a foot's length out of its scabbard. "This horse is definitely a buttercup, or I should say has been one at some time or other," said the stranger, continuing his examination and addressing his listeners at the window without appearing to notice D'Artagnan, who, in his rage, had backed round and was now standing between him and them. "It's a colour common in flowers, but still very rare in horses."
"One can laugh at a horse and still be afraid to laugh at its rider," cried Treville's pupil in a passion.
"I don't often laugh, sir," said the stranger, "as no doubt you can tell from my face. But I hold to my right of laughing whenever it suits me."
"And I won't have anyone laughing when it doesn't suit me," cried D'Artagnan.
"Really, sir?" said the stranger more quietly than ever.
"Well, that's quite understandable. and turning on his heel, he walked towards the main gate of the inn, under which D'Artagnan, on his arrival, had noticed a saddled and bridled horse. But D'Artagnan was not the man to allow anyone to hold him up to ridicule. He drew his sword right out of its scabbard and ran after the stranger, crying, "Turn and face me, sir! I've had enough of your damned sneering. Turn and face me, or I'll run you through the back." The stranger turned sharply and eyed D'Artagnan with an expression of mingled surprise and scorn. "Run me through? Me?" he cried. "What are you talking about? Are you mad?" Then, in an undertone, as though talking to himself, he added, "What a pity this is. This young hothead would have made an admirable musketeer." And the king always on the lookout for fresh blood. Hardly were the words out of his mouth before D'Artagnan lunged at him so furiously that had he not stepped quickly aside, he would probably not have lived to make another joke. He now realized that the affair was serious, drew his sword, saluted his opponent, and stood on guard. But at that moment the innkeeper and the two who had been standing with the stranger at the window fell on D'Artagnan with sticks, shovels, and tongs. This created a diversion so rapid and so complete that while D'Artagnan turned to defend himself against this rain of blows, his opponent quickly sheathed his sword and once more became a spectator instead of an actor in the drama, a role which seemed to become him better. But he muttered to himself, "Hell take these Gascons. Why can't he get on that saffron horse of his and be off?" "Not till I've killed you, you coward!" cried D'Artagnan, fighting back hard against his three assailants, who were plastering him with blows. "Another of these swaggerers," muttered the stranger. "God, these Gascons are incorrigible. Well, carry on the fight, then, since he insists on it. When he's had enough, he'll let us know." But the stranger did not realize what an obstinate fellow he had to deal with. D'Artagnan was not the man to give in without a struggle. So the fight went on for another few seconds, until at last D'Artagnan, in his exhaustion, dropped his sword, which was instantly broken with a heavy blow from a stick. Another blow, levelled at his forehead, knocked him to the ground where he lay prostrate, bleeding and almost unconscious. It was at this moment that the crowd began to collect from all sides. The innkeeper, fearing a scandal, summoned his stable boys and had the wounded man removed from the scene and carried into the kitchen, where his wounds were roughly dressed. The stranger, meanwhile, went back to his place at the window and stood looking with some impatience at the crowd outside. Its presence seemed to cause him great annoyance. "Well, how's that young lunatic?" said he, turning as the door opened and addressing the innkeeper, who had come to inquire after his health. "I trust your excellency is none the worse," asked the innkeeper. "No, I'm all right, but I'd like to know what's happened to our young friend." "He's calmer now," said the innkeeper. "In fact, he's fainted." "Oh, he's fainted, has he?" said the gentleman. "Yes, but before he finally collapsed, he staggered to his feet, turned in your direction, and shouted a challenge." "That fellow's the devil himself," cried the stranger. "Oh, no, sir. He's not the devil," answered the innkeeper with a sneer. "I can vouch for that. While he was unconscious, we searched him and found that he had only one shirt to his name and only 12 crowns in his purse. But for all that, before he fainted, he said that had such a thing happened in Paris, you'd have been made to regret it at once, whereas here you've got off, though only for the time being." "Oh, if he said that, he must be some royal prince in disguise," said the stranger coldly. "I'm only telling you this to put you on your guard, Your Honour," said the innkeeper. "Did he mention anybody's name by any chance?" "Oh, yes. He slapped his pocket and said, 'We'll see what Monsieur de Tréville thinks when he hears about this.'"
"Monsieur de Tréville?" exclaimed the stranger with a start.
"He slapped his pocket and mentioned Monsieur de Tréville. Well, now, my good man, don't tell me you didn't search that pocket of his while he was lying there. What did you find in it?"
"A letter, addressed to Monsieur de Tréville, Captain of the Musketeers."
"Is that a fact?" "Yes, Your Honour. It says I'm telling you."
The innkeeper, who was rather dense, did not notice the effect of his words on the stranger. The latter now left the window at which he had been standing, with his elbow resting on the sill, and came forward, an anxious frown on his face.
"This is the very devil," he muttered to himself.
Could Treville have sent this Gascon against me? He's a bit young, I know, but a sword thrust's a sword thrust, no matter who deals it. And a boy might catch me off my guard. The small obstacle can sometimes defeat a great enterprise, and the stranger thought for a moment. Then, addressing the innkeeper, he said, "Look here, my good man. Can't you get this young lunatic out of the way somehow? I can't in all conscience kill him, but," he added, frowning again, "at present he's a nuisance here. Where is he now?" "In my wife's room on the first floor. They're dressing his wounds." "I suppose he's got his clothes and his bag with him, and he's still wearing his doublet?" "No, sir. All his things are down in the kitchen, but if this fellow's a nuisance to you, of course he's a nuisance. He's causing a disturbance in your inn, which decent folk won't put up with. Go upstairs, make out my bill, and call my servant." "What, sir? You're leaving us already? You know I'm leaving. Didn't I tell you to get my horse saddled? Hasn't it been done?" "It has been done, sir. Your Excellency may have noticed your horse is at the main gate, all ready for the journey." "Well, do as I tell you, then." The innkeeper looked at his guest with raised eyebrows, as though to say, "So you're frightened of that young whippersnapper, are you?" But a stern look from the stranger brought him to his senses. He bowed low and left the room. "That young scamp mustn't be allowed to see Milady," thought the stranger. "She'll be here at any moment. In fact, she's late already. It would really be better if I rode out to meet her. If only I could find out what was in that letter addressed to Treville." And the stranger, muttering these words, made his way slowly down to the kitchen. Meanwhile, the innkeeper, who was convinced that it was the young man's presence which had decided the stranger to leave his inn, had gone to his wife's room, where he had found D'Artagnan, restored to consciousness. Telling him that he was in for a load of trouble with the authorities, for having provoked a nobleman, for in his opinion the stranger was certainly a nobleman, the innkeeper persuaded D'Artagnan, in spite of his exhaustion, to get up and be off. So D'Artagnan, half dazed, with only his shirt and breeches on, and with his head swathed in bandages, staggered to his feet, and urged from behind by the host, went down the stairs. But on reaching the kitchen, the first thing he saw through the window was his enemy standing at the footboard of a heavy coach, harnessed to two large Normandy horses, talking to a lady seated inside. Only this lady's head and shoulders were visible through the coach window. She was between 20 and 22 years old. We have already stated D'Artagnan's capacity to take in at a glance every detail of a person's appearance. He therefore noticed at once that the woman was young and beautiful, and her looks struck him more forcibly because they were of a kind entirely foreign to the southern provinces where he was born and bred. The lady was fair and pale, with long golden ringlets which fell to her shoulders, large blue languishing eyes, rose-red lips, and hands as white as alabaster. She was talking eagerly to the stranger. "So His Eminence's orders are," said the lady, "that you return to England at once and let him know the moment the Duke leaves London." "And what about my other instructions?" said the beautiful traveller. "They're here in this box, that you're not to open till you've crossed the Channel." "Very well, and what about you?" "I'm returning to Paris." "What? Without putting that rude young puppy in his place?" asked the lady. The stranger was about to reply when D'Artagnan, who had heard everything, rushed into the doorway. "You're wrong there," he cried. "It's the rude young puppy who's going to put you in your place, and this time I'll see you don't escape as you did before." "Escape?" repeated the stranger, frowning. "Yes, sir, for I don't suppose even you'll turn tail in the presence of a woman." At this the stranger seized hold of his sword, but the lady quickly intervened. "Remember, the least delay may prove fatal," she cried. "You're right," said the stranger. "You go your way and I'll go mine. And let's be quick about it." He bowed to the lady and leapt into the saddle while the coachman whipped up his horses. And the lady and gentleman made off at top speed, disappearing down opposite ends of the street. "Hi there, your bill!" shouted the innkeeper, his affection for his guest changing to scorn as he saw him make off without settling his account. "Pay, varlet!" cried the stranger to his servant, turning sideways on his horse.
The lackey threw a couple of silver coins at the innkeeper's feet and then galloped off after his master.
"Coward! Rogue! Call yourself a gentleman!" cried D'Artagnan, rushing off in turn in pursuit of master and servant.
But the young man was still too weak to indulge in such strenuous efforts. Hardly had he gone 10 yards than his ears began to throb, giddiness seized him, the blood rushed to his head, and he collapsed in the middle of the street, still yelling, "Coward! Coward! Coward!" The innkeeper walked up to him as he lay prostrate. "Yes, he's a coward, all right," he said. He hoped by this piece of civility to get on good terms with the impoverished young man, like the heron in the fable with the snail which it had scorned the previous night.
"Yes, a proper coward," gasped D'Artagnan. "But she, how lovely she is."
"She, what she?" asked the innkeeper.
"Milady," stammered D'Artagnan, and then he fainted for the second time.
"That doesn't really matter," thought the innkeeper. "I've lost 2 customers, but kept one. And this fellow'll be here for several days, so in any case I'm bound to be 11 crowns up." We know that 11 crowns was the exact sum still left in D'Artagnan's purse. The innkeeper had reckoned on 11 days' illness at the rate of 1 crown a day, but he hadn't reckoned with his guest. At 5 o'clock next morning, D'Artagnan got up, went down himself to the kitchen and asked for wine, oil, rosemary, and various other items needed for an ointment. Then, with his mother's prescription in front of him, he prepared this ointment, and with it proceeded to dress and redress his many wounds, refusing all outside aid. Thanks, no doubt, to the healing properties of the gypsy's ointment, and also, perhaps, to the absence of the doctor, D'Artagnan was up and about that very evening, and next day almost well again. Now it was a question of paying for the wine, oil, and rosemary. This was, in fact, our hero's only debt, for he had himself refused all nourishment, although, from what the innkeeper said, the yellow nag had devoured 3 times more than one would have thought possible for a beast of its size. But when the young man felt in his pocket for the money, he found only his little threadbare velvet purse containing the 11 crowns. The letter to Monsieur de Tréville had disappeared. For a while the young man searched patiently for the letter, turning his breast and waist pockets inside out 20 times and more, rummaging about in his bag and delving into his purse. But when it dawned on him that the letter was really and truly missing, he was seized with a further attack of rage, which nearly called for a fresh supply of the spiced wine and oil. For when the innkeeper saw our fractious young friend getting excited and threatening to break up the whole house if his letter were not returned to him, he seized hold of a pike, while his wife took up a broom and his boys armed themselves with the sticks which they had so successfully wielded 2 days before.
"My letter! My letter of introduction!" cried D'Artagnan. "Give it back, or by God, I'll run you all through like larks on a spit."
Unfortunately, one thing stood in the way of our young friend carrying out his threat. His sword had been split in two in the original fight, and this he had forgotten. The result was that when he grasped the hilt, he found himself armed with a mere stump 8 to 10 inches long, which the innkeeper had carefully replaced inside the scabbard. The cook had already taken the rest of the blade to use as a larding pin. But our young hothead would probably have carried on in spite of this setback, had not the innkeeper suddenly realized that his claim was perfectly justified.
"Now wait a moment," said he, lowering his pike. "I wonder where that letter is." "Yes, where is it?" cried D'Artagnan. "Listen, my good man, that letter is for Monsieur de Tréville and must be found. If it's not found now, you may be sure he'll get it out of you later."
With this threat, D'Artagnan succeeded in bringing the innkeeper to heel. Next to the king and the cardinal, Monsieur de Tréville was more spoken of by soldiers, and even by civilians, than any man in the kingdom. There was Father Joseph, of course, but his name was only mentioned in whispers, so great was the terror inspired by his grey eminence, the cardinal's shadow. So, throwing away his pike and ordering his wife to put back her broom and his boys their sticks, the innkeeper set to work to search for the missing letter.
"Did this letter contain anything of value?" he asked, after searching fruitlessly for some time. "Good God, I should say it did," cried the Gascon,
who was relying on this letter to give him an entry into court circles. "It contained my whole fortune."
"Spanish bonds or what?" asked the innkeeper anxiously.
"Bonds in His Majesty's own treasury," replied D'Artagnan.
It was a bold statement, but his whole future was at stake.
"Oh, Lord, oh, Lord," cried the innkeeper, "this is terrible."
"The money's not important," continued D'Artagnan, with true Gascon impudence. "I don't care tuppence about the money. It's the letter that matters. I'd rather have lost 1,000 pistoles than that letter."
He could just as well have said 20,000, but his youthful modesty restrained him. Suddenly the innkeeper, who was cursing himself for a fool, had an inspiration.
"That letter's not lost," he cried. "Not lost," repeated D'Artagnan. "No, it's been stolen from you."
"Stolen? Who by?"
"By the gentleman who was here yesterday. He went down to the kitchen where your doublet was. He was alone in there. I'm ready to bet he stole the letter."
"Oh, so you think he stole it," replied D'Artagnan without much conviction.
He knew quite well that the letter was of merely personal value and could not imagine that anyone would want to steal it. It was obvious that none of the guests or servants at present at the inn would have had any use for it.
"So you really and truly suspect that gentleman," continued D'Artagnan.
"I repeat, I'm sure of it," replied the innkeeper.
"When I told him Your Excellency was Monsieur de Tréville's protégé, and that you even had a letter with that great man's name on it, he seemed very upset. He asked me where the letter was, and went down at once to the kitchen where he knew he'd find your doublet."
"Oh, so he is the thief after all," replied D'Artagnan.
"I shall inform Monsieur de Tréville of this, and he'll tell the king."
Then, with a flourish, he drew 2 crowns from his pocket and tossed them to the innkeeper, who, cap in hand, went with him to the door. D'Artagnan now leapt onto his yellow horse, and finally, after a long and exhausting ride, reached the Porte Saint-Antoine in Paris. Here he sold the horse for the sum of 3 crowns, which was a good price, considering that it had been hard-pressed for the last stage of the journey. The dealer who bought the horse declared that he only paid this enormous sum because of the animal's unusual colour. So D'Artagnan eventually entered Paris on foot, carrying all his worldly goods under his arm. He wandered about the streets until he at last found a room to let, at a price which suited his slender means, a mere attic in the Rue des Fossoyeurs near the Luxembourg. After paying his deposit, D'Artagnan settled himself in his new quarters and spent the rest of the day sewing onto his doublet and hose certain trimmings which his mother had unstitched from an almost new doublet belonging to his father and given to him on the sly. Then he visited the Quai de la Ferraille to have a new blade fitted to his sword, later returning to the Louvre to inquire from the first musketeer whom he happened to meet the whereabouts of Monsieur de Tréville's house. When he learnt that it was in the Rue du Vieux Colombier, quite close to his own little attic, his spirits rose, for he considered this a good omen for the success of his journey. Finally, thoroughly satisfied with the way he had behaved at Meaux, without regret for the past, confident in the present, and hopeful for the future, he went to bed and slept the sleep of the just. This sleep, the sleep of a rustic rather than that of a man of fashion, lasted till 9 the next morning. At this late hour he got up, dressed and prepared to meet the great Monsieur de Tréville, who, in his father's view, was the 3rd most important man in the kingdom.